Hello, this is Wendy Bauer. I will be reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review, dated October 26, 2015. We're going to begin today's reading with a featured article by Huey Freeman and Valerie Wells, staff writers, Decatur Receives Twin Towers Beam from 9/11. Firefighters, police officers, and motorcyclists honored the victims of the terrorist attacks of 9/11 by providing an impressive motorcade for a steel I-beam that was salvaged from the wreckage of New York City's World Trade Center. Starting out from Cozier Harley-Davidson dealership at 1:15 p.m. Saturday, firefighters from about 20 Central Illinois departments and officers from several police agencies blasted their sirens and flashed their emergency lights as they drove at a steady clip to the Decatur Airport. Because of the dogged determination of individuals at George A. Mueller Beer Company, the steel beam, one of the last pieces of the Twin Towers available, was donated to the Decatur community to be used as the centerpiece for a monument, which will likely be on display at Nelson Park. The beam, which was driven from New York to Decatur on a flatbed trailer with state police escorts along most of the six-state route, will remain at the airport until the monument's design is completed. The journey toward receiving the 13-foot-long, 1,500-pound beam began with a boat ride on Lake Placid, New York. Eric Mueller, owner of the beer distributor, was in the area for a wedding with his wife, Kathy, when they struck up a conversation with another couple. The man said he was a former New York firefighter who took early retirement due to health problems resulting from working at Ground Zero following the collapse of the towers. Mueller was wondering what happened to all the steel from those tremendous piles. The former firefighter said some was sent to China, where it was melted down. A lot of it was dropped in the ocean. Officials did not want it to be used for commercial purposes. The commercial airliner suicide attacks on September 11, 2001, took the lives of 343 firefighters and 60 law enforcement officers in New York City, the greatest tragedy in the nation's history for first responders. When Mueller returned to Decatur, he discussed with Lauren Axe, the company's controller, the possibility of obtaining steel from the fallen buildings. After discovering that the New York Port Authority controlled the materials, she obtained a spot on a list to possibly receive a piece of history. "There were just 30 pieces left," she said. "We were 150th on the list." Despite those long odds, Axe was not discouraged. She submitted a plan specifying that the Decatur Monument would resemble the Twin Towers. She received letters of support from political and community leaders, including the late Mayor Mike McElroy, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, State Senator Chapin Rose, former City Manager Ryan McCrady, Decatur Fire and Police Departments, and Macon County Sheriff Thomas Schneider. "I just kept calling. About every week we sent a letter of support in," Axe said. Finally, on August 7th, we got an email saying we had an opportunity to accept a beam. Her husband, John, who picked up the beam at John F. Kennedy International Airport on Wednesday morning, said the beam had a tag on it marking it for the National September 11th Museum. "They decided to give it to us," said John Axe after speaking to a crowd gathered at the airport about his journey from the East Coast. He said he drove on interstates and back roads. When he stopped in some towns, people asked him to stay a while so other people could see the beam. "In Attica, Indiana, there were 400 people waiting for us wanting to see it," John Axe said. Bob Brilley II, vice president of the Decatur Park District Board, said the tentative plan is to display the monument on the lakefront in the vicinity of the Beach House restaurant. "Our park district will be involved in it," Brilley said. "We're really proud to have it." A total of $55,000 is needed to construct the memorial and create a maintenance fund, Lauren Axe said. All donations for the memorial will be held by the 9/11 Memorial Community Foundation and are tax deductible. To contribute, go online to www.endowdecatur.org. And from Tony Reed, staff writer for Herald and Review, Halloween in the Halls. Millikan students stage zombie hunt for treat seekers. It begins with a photograph of a couple of small children dressed up for Halloween and one older person dressed up like a zombie. Trick or treating on the street is so gravely uncool compared to the joys of prowling darkened college dorms collecting candy while shooting zombies with foam dart guns. Such was the fun to be had Sunday afternoon when Millikan University's Student Housing Council staged its Halloween in the Halls event. Students dressed up to host parties of visiting costumed children who went on guided tours through decorated residence halls dripping with free candy. But a new wrinkle in the 15-year history of Halloween in the Halls was the interactive tour of Weck Hall featuring enthusiastic but remarkably kind student zombies like freshman nursing major Alice Barnard. She sprang out at Carson Kaplinger, a 7-year-old costumed and candy-hungry warrior from Decatur, and was mercilessly hammered with foam darts. He pursued her out of the dorm corridor into a stairwell, but at one point, when he ran out of ammo, 19-year-old Bernard helped him reload the student-supplied gun so he could carry on shooting her. "I took a lot of theater," she said, when asked to explain how she achieved her ferocious zombie look that only broke character when she assisted her pursuer, "and I love doing this." All the students involved in Halloween in the Halls looked like they were having a grand time of it, waiting to welcome visiting kids to decorated dorms that offered both scary and non-scary tours. The ages of trick-or-treaters ranged from 2 to 14, and more than 150 of them, accompanied by parents, surged through campus for their crash course in candy collection. Sophomore Donna Bull, 19, the residence hall event coordinator for Student Housing Council, said planning for the Halloween treat had gone on for more than 2 months. She said it was a gift from the students to the community, and everybody involved enjoyed the experience. "The students put a lot of work into decorating the halls, and it's a good time," said Bull. Their visiting trick-or-treaters got into the spirit by sporting some remarkable looks, too. The Tate siblings from Decatur, for example, went for a farm theme, with Abigail, 12, wearing a rubber pig mask, while sister Isabella, 10, donned a horse head, and 11-year-old brother Oakley wore a rubber chicken head. The children said they all liked the idea of a less decoration is more approach by wearing face masks and farmish clothing rather than full-body costumes. "We didn't want costumes because we're getting older," explained Isabella. And Tony Reed brings another article with a Halloween theme from Decatur. Frights and Sights, Butcher Shop Decor Turns Heads Along Lake Shore Drive. The scary thing about the average store-bought inflatable Halloween yard decoration these days is it's about as exciting as chopped liver. But jaded eyeballs prowling along the much-traveled East Lakeshore Drive in Decatur are in for an adrenaline jolt when they bump into the home of Becky and Rob Monska. There, as if marching toward you across the front yard of their circa 1912 home, is a maniacally grinning life-size clown mannequin wrapped in a plasma-stained apron with a bloody meat cleaver swinging in his sprung left hand. On a table in front of him is a red-stained sheet covering what appears to be the remains of a body, odd plastic faux limbs scattered in a pile in front of it. Behind the clown are various grinning heads on sticks, and there's a helpful sign with a downward-facing arrow announcing, "Ground Chuck, $2.89 a pound." Becky Monska, 40, who likes a little jest with her nightmares, says the idea of the tableau is a clown butcher shop with prime Homo sapiens beef on the menu. Passing drivers can't cut their eyes away from it, which may explain what happened the other day. "One car rear-ended another," says Monska. "Well, I don't know," she adds when asked if at least one of the drivers was rubbernecking her Halloween decorations, "but it happened right there at the lights," and she points to the traffic signals near her spacious yard. Monska has been enthralled with things that go bump in the night since she was a tiny kid. Halloween is her favorite celebration, and she believes in digging deep to come up with something a little different. She doesn't look down on people who go the relatively safe, air-blown decoration route. If you are willing to decorate, that's awesome in my book. But feels a grave sense of obligation herself to step it up, or perhaps down, a notch. Her husband can dig it too, and is a willing participant in her fiendish ideas. In fact, he's the one who has encouraged his wife to go the tableau route and work on having a focal point of terror. Instead of just having yard decorations everywhere, I told her we need to do like a centerpiece, he says, and I think this year's is the best one yet. Which is saying something. Last year's theme, for example, was dug earth graves on the front lawn featuring real dug earth, with a bunch of full-size skeletons standing and lying around clutching beer cans as if partying eternity away. I look forward to creating something new every year, says Becky Monska, who also said she couldn't create it all without the enthusiastic help of her nephew, 16-year-old Dylan Monska. We love doing it. It's a lot of fun, she adds. The scary part is that having set the fright decoration bar so high, she's got to keep pricking her inspirational thumb so that something even more wicked this way comes for Halloween 2016. And I've already got next year's idea in mind, she said. It will be a nod to Stephen King, but that's all I'm saying. And no matter how terrifying it is, Monska knows we'll all have to sneak a look despite the better angels of our nature. She says that has been the universal appeal of horror movies and page-turning scary books since Bram Stoker penned Dracula in 1897. It's like driving past a car wreck, she explains. You don't want to look, but you kind of find yourself looking anyway. And from Decatur, Chris Lizvardi, staff writer, writes, Millikan women's basketball rallies around heart cause. Alyssa Saklak wasn't sure what to expect when she set out to raise awareness about heart disease in memory of her father, Rick Saklak. As it turned out, Alyssa Saklak found the support from her teammates on the Millikan University women's basketball team quickly spread throughout the Decatur community. We've all been touched by this, she said, about heart disease, which is the nation's leading cause of death. We've seen the impact of how precious life is and how we can make a difference if we come together. Everyone on the team got involved. The team ended up raising $2,301 as they participated Saturday in the Macon County Heart Walk at Fairview Park. Saklak said it had initially set a goal of $250 for the event, which is a fundraiser for the American Heart Association. She made a video sharing her story that was posted on YouTube, and as it spread for others in the community to see, donations picked up. The basketball team's effort was just one example of how community members come together to support the event, said Karen Gedros, Corporate Events Director for the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association. Many participants take part in the event to honor family members, and participating heart disease and stroke survivors were given red or white hats to wear. I'm blown away by the teams and individuals who raise money, Gedros said. We have exceeded expectations. The goal is to raise $65,000 from the event, as donations will continue to be collected over the next month, Gedros said. Saklak, who is a senior nursing major, hopes her efforts can help others after an unexpected loss affected her. Rick Saklak died at the age of 57 in July 2014 from cardiovascular disease. It was the first of it in my family, Alyssa Saklak said. That sparked my passion. It has changed how my family works. Saklak's team saw her passion for the cause and knew how much her father meant to her and to them. He would make his presence felt, cheering and supporting the team, particularly at away games in the Chicago area when fewer Millikan fans were around. The family is from Schaumburg, and Alyssa has three older siblings. I think Rick would be really proud of what Alyssa has done, said Millikan senior basketball player Alice Morehouse, who is from Mount Auburn. He loved his kids and family. Rick Saklak was supportive of Alyssa's high school team as well, said Kelly Scorsese, a Millikan senior from Schaumburg who also played basketball with Alyssa in high school. Scorsese remembers him being a part of the team dinners that brought families together. He brought the same enthusiasm to Milliken, she said. We picked up here where we left off. Saklak said Milliken's coaches encouraged them to honor her father and in the process help the community. We wanted to do something to remember Rick, Milliken assistant coach Joanna Connor said. We want to support Decatur as a whole, too. The Heart Walk took on added significance this year for event chairman Matt Briggs, whose wife's grandfather died of congestive heart failure earlier this year. He said educating the community about preventing heart disease and stroke is important while promoting a heart-healthy lifestyle. The number of participants has held steady at about 800 the past 2 years, said Briggs, a controller at Decatur Industrial Electric. For an event like this, the community responds, Briggs said. It always has a great turnout. It's pretty special, and that has a lot to do with the community. Learning to watch for the warning signs of stroke is important, along with reducing risk factors such as smoking and eating healthier, said Dr. Rajesh Kumar, a hospitalist at Decatur Memorial Hospital. It can make a big difference, Kumar said. Stroke is deadly. Teams from both hospitals in Decatur, Decatur Memorial Hospital and HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, participated in the event. Other businesses with high participation included Tate and Lyle, Union Iron, and Richland Community College. And from Saturday's paper by Huey Freeman, a staff writer for Herald and Review from Decatur, woman accused of stealing from firm's payroll. A 45-year-old Decatur woman was arrested and booked into the Macon County Jail Tuesday on a felony theft charge for allegedly writing checks to herself from a business account and increasing her own pay while serving as office manager for a Decatur firm. Danielle Nakmus, a former employee of Binder Plumbing and Heating, Inc., admitted to police that she utilized the payroll account for financial gain during personal financial struggles, said a probable cause affidavit by Decatur Police Detective Jeremy Oppenzeller. The total loss to the company during a period of about 17 months, ending in July, was $44,385, company officials told police. More than half of the pilfered funds were a result of the employee supplementing her paychecks. Naxmuth alleged that it routinely added unauthorized overtime to her paychecks, inflated her hourly wage by $10 an hour on multiple occasions, and used the business account and business credit cards for personal purchases. Nakmus appropriated for herself a total of $25,565 in unauthorized wages, Appenzeller wrote in his statement. Household bills were paid by her employer's business accounts, including $2,565 to Ameren, Illinois, $3,227 to Verizon Wireless, and $932 to Comcast. Nakmus spent more than $5,000 at the Menards store in Forsyth from her employer's account. When her personal vehicle needed a transmission, she used the firm's money to pay the $781 bill. When the business owner gave her $1,400 in cash to pay a bill for him, she allegedly pocketed the cash and paid the bill from a business account. Seven checks from a business account, ranging from $216 to $3,000, were written to herself while she was employed at the firm. The total of the checks was $4,500. Nakmus, who was released from custody after posting $5,000 cash bail on Wednesday, is due in court November 20th for her arraignment. An article from Normal by Lenore Sabota, a Lee News Service writer, from October 25th. Normal couple's small dog survives coyote attack. This begins with a photograph of Mary Beth Richard holding her 3-year-old Shih Tzu, Gracie, who is recovering after being attacked by coyotes outside her rural Normal home. Mary Beth Richard has heard coyotes in the middle of the night around her rural, normal home many times, but they never caused any problems until early Friday morning, a couple hours before sunrise. Her husband, Daniel, had let out their two little dogs, 3-year-old Gracie, a Shih Tzu, and 11-year-old Stitchy, a Peek-a-Poo, and went to get his truck. The dogs usually walked around the perimeter of the house. Then he heard Gracie yelping and then Stitchy just terrorizing something, Richard said. When he went to see what was going on, he saw two sets of eyes. They started coming toward him and they just then took off. They believe the eyes belonged to a pair of coyotes. A short distance away, her husband found Gracie with several puncture wounds covered in dirt and burrs, Richard said. Stitchy's barking, standing his ground and attracting Daniel Richard's attention, apparently induced the coyotes to drop Gracie, Mary Beth Richard said. He can be vicious if he wants to. He has an attitude, she said of Stitchy. He saved her life. He's the hero. Wildlife biologist Angelo Caparella, an Illinois State University associate professor, said coyotes normally prey on rabbits and rodents, but it is true they occasionally have an encounter with a small dog or cat. Caparella said coyotes have adapted well to urban areas, and there probably are more of the secretive critters around Bloomington Normal than people realize. The coyotes are important local predators that keep things down that could get out of control, he said. The Urban Coyote Project in Chicago has not found any reports of attacks on people, according to Caparella. The University of Illinois Extension, on its Living with Wildlife in Illinois webpage, advises, do not leave small pets outside unattended, especially at night. It defines small animals as less than 20 pounds and recommends an enclosure with a fence 6 to 8 feet high to keep out coyotes. Richard initially took Gracie to their local veterinarian, Dr. Bernie Bleem, at Kruger Animal Hospital. He found 3 puncture wounds, broken ribs, and a punctured lung, she said. At his recommendation, she took Gracie to the University of Illinois Veterinary Teaching Hospital in Urbana, where the tiny dog underwent 5 hours of surgery, Richard said. They put Gracie's ribs back together and took some muscle off her shoulder to rebuild the chest wall, Richard said. They can't believe that she made it, Richard said as she cradled Gracie in her home east of Tawanda Barnes Road. The veterinary bills are approaching $5,000, but more than $840 has already been pledged through a GoFundMe page she created. She has also received support and praise for Stitchy on other social media, such as the For the Love of a Shih Tzu Facebook page. There are good people out there. It has humbled my heart, Richard said. I can't believe the outpouring from people, including offers of help and prayers. She wants others to be aware of the danger. If you have animals, keep an eye on them, she said. Richard said she realizes that coyotes face challenges and new subdivisions that are coming in are taking over their territory. She said, I'm not for killing animals, but added, no more coyotes better come near her house. Meanwhile, neither dog is going outside unless Richard or her husband is watching them. That's fine with Gracie. She does not like to go outside now, Richard said. As for Stitchy, he pretty much stays with her since she came home. And from Decatur, Allison Petty, staff writer, writes, City plans cleanups next week. The popular city-sponsored neighborhood cleanup events from this spring will return for 3 days this week. From 3 to 6 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday, residents will be able to dispose of large items, including a limited amount of tires, said Rochelle Irons, the city's director of neighborhood services. Large dumpsters will be available in a different neighborhood park each day, and city staff will be on hand to supervise. Irons said the event provides an opportunity for people to clean out their homes and basements, and even to dispose of large items, such as furniture that has been dumped in their neighborhoods. No electronics will be accepted. There is an issue with people dumping in alleys. If that ends up being adjacent to your property, then you're liable for that, she said. On the neighborhood walks, we heard about a lot of people dumping in alleys, so we know that that's a concern. This is a way to alleviate that. Advanced Disposal donated use of the dumpsters and labor to remove them, but the city is paying for tire disposal. Money for the cleanups comes from a neighborhood improvements fund that the city established in 2005. Decatur City Council members specified earlier this year that they would like to see the money used in part for citywide cleanup activities. The cleanup locations are Johns Hill Park on Tuesday, Galloway Park on Wednesday, and Garfield Park on Thursday. And from Decatur, Valerie Wells writes, "Students to get free breakfast lunch." Beginning on November 1st, students throughout the Decatur School District will receive both breakfast and lunch for free. "For us, this is a kind of a transition," said Todd Kovalt, the district's chief operational officer. "We've had this in the breakfast program. We only have the two high schools and two other buildings that don't have free breakfasts, and those will be offered free breakfast effective November 1st also." Decatur schools qualify for the community eligibility provision included in the 2010 Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act that provides schools in low-income areas with an alternative school meal program. "If you have a family of three, this is pretty significant," Kovalt said. "Full-price lunch at $2 a day times 170 days of school, that's a significant chunk of change. If they want a free breakfast as well, that's additional savings. This will also remove the stigma some students might feel about being on the free and reduced price program. While it doesn't seem to affect elementary schools as much, participation in school meals drops off in middle and high schools nationwide. Educators believe it's because older students don't want to be identified as low income, even though in Decatur schools, for example, students swipe their ID cards at the cash register and only the computer knows which are getting free or reduced price lunches. The hope is that when all students are eating for free, more students will participate and fewer will spend the school day hungry. The district still has to keep count of the number of meals and the contents of those meals. Meals only count if students take all the required components, even if they don't eat everything. Because other district programs meant to benefit a low-income population depend on the number of students eligible for free and reduced price lunch," said Scott Gregory, food service director for Aramark, "there was a concern that the program wouldn't be economically feasible. But because low-income statistics are also figured through eligibility for Medicaid and other state programs, and parents fill out applications for those, the district will still be able to receive those funds. It's proven that kids that are fed a good, healthy meal learn better, pay attention better, and soak up more," Gregory said. "We've seen a huge improvement in schools where we do breakfast in the classroom. Attention spans are longer, and they're not going to the nurse with headaches and upset stomachs. It's just a huge win-win." And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, October 26th, 2015. Please stay tuned.